Hi, this is Cindy from My Nursing Mastery, and today we're going to cover IVs. So today we're going to be talking about all of the main points nurses need to know for intravenous access. This includes peripheral IVs, midline catheters, and central venous access devices. Central venous access devices includes PICC lines, tunneled and non-tunneled lines, and implantable ports. As with other podcasts, when you hear this sound, pay special attention as this may show up on the NCLEX. IV stands for intravenous as opposed to intra-arterial. For the most part, intravenous is used to put things into the body, and intra-arterial lines are used diagnostically or procedurally or to monitor hemodynamics. We're going to begin by talking generally about some key points for all intravenous lines, and then we'll talk about each one specifically, so that no matter what kind of line your patient needs, you'll know what you're doing. Anytime an IV is inserted, the body's natural defense is compromised. So nurses must be diligent about infection prevention. This is especially true for central venous lines that provide direct access to major vessels in the heart. Intravenous devices account for more than half of bloodstream infections in some studies. Even if the care provided is high quality, common microorganisms like staph, which is found on the skin, can easily enter the body through an IV site. In recent years, more than 100,000 patients were infected with staph aureus in the U.S. just in 1 year. Nurses can make a huge impact by simply paying attention to hand hygiene and infection prevention practices when placing and accessing IVs, and identifying signs of infection promptly. The CDC and the INS, or the Infusion Nurses Society, has standards that guide best practice for IV placement and maintenance. These are definitely your go-to resources for all things IV in nursing. Let's just review some key points for preventing infection. First, for hand hygiene, use a naked-to-the-elbow approach. Remove any stoned rings and make sure watches or bracelets are kept away from hands and gloves. This is best practice whether you're placing an IV, removing an IV, or even accessing an IV to, say, hang a piggyback medication. Another time to pay attention to strict hand hygiene is during dressing changes. Practice asepsis. Use sterile supplies and make sure that the insertion site is properly disinfected. This means that when you are inserting an IV, you should not palpate the surrounding skin with non-sterile gloves once it has been disinfected. Many nurses will find their vein and then disinfect the site and then go back in to palpate again. This is incorrect. It also means nurses should learn proper disinfection techniques, including the use of adequate friction. Friction helps to remove microorganisms when scrubbing the site. IV sites should be covered with an occlusive dressing that is clear, so it can be assessed every shift for signs of infection, and it should remain clean and dry. Get in the habit early on assessing the site every time you use it. Inserting and manipulating access hubs on tubing and IV pigtails requires asepsis as well. Every additional point of access, such as a lure lock, provides a way for microorganisms to enter the bloodstream. Although sterile gloves are not necessary, disinfection of the access point definitely is. It's easy to make the excuse you are in a hurry, but it really is essential to get in the habit of disinfecting ports and connectors. When patients see nurses do this, it increases patient satisfaction by increasing trust that care quality is a priority. Get to know your facility policies regarding how often tubing and IVs should be changed. In most places, IV tubing must be changed every 72 to 96 hours, and the site is rotated every 3 to 5 days as well. The most recent CDC recommendations say that IVs can stay in place longer if there are no signs of infection, but most facilities stick with the 3 to 5 day rule. And when infection is suspected, central lines are often removed and the catheter tip should be placed in a sterile cup and sent to the lab for culture. Now that we've talked about infection prevention, let's cover some other general points that apply to all intravenous lines. Patency is a concern for all IV access types, that is, keeping the IV line open. Make sure you know your facility policy on maintaining these sites and what to do when there is a problem with access. Catheter flow rates and allowed infusion pressures vary according to the size, length, site, and anatomical location of an IV line. Keep this in mind when providing medications and fluids. Think about what this patient needs for their particular situation. Verifying and maintaining IV patency is an important nursing priority. Flushing and locking procedures may vary by facility and IV type. However, flushing and locking is a standard practice for preventing occlusion. Here's some important points. Flushing a catheter means injecting normal saline, usually to clear the line. Locking is a term used to describe the injection of a small amount of solution, either normal saline or heparinized saline, to prevent a clot in the catheter. For peripheral IVs with standard ports, use positive pressure by clamping the tubing as the last bit of fluid is injected. This helps prevent backflow. Check whether your facility requires positive pressure ports and hubs. These do not allow manual positive pressure to be applied. Knowing your equipment is essential. For a direct manual injection, use a 10 ml syringe for all IVs, except peripheral IVs, in which you could use a 3 to 5 ml syringe. When not in use, keep IV tubing and connector clamps closed. For IV placement, remember to always adhere to your level of expertise and scope of practice. If you are just learning peripheral IV placement, follow guidelines on difficult sticks and rely on team-based care. Many facilities have IV teams that specialize in IV access, and these colleagues are great resources. It's essential to secure any IVs to prevent complications. If you are focused on mastering IV starts, practice before you practice. Check out our topic in My Nursing Mastery, complete with a video tutorial. Okay, let's begin by talking about the least invasive intravenous lines, and that is peripheral IVs. Here are some tips. Vascular access devices are selected based on patient need. Nurses should be aware of indications for peripheral IVs versus a central line and provide advocacy. If you notice that your patient has a drug ordered that can be irritating, you may suggest to the provider a central line instead of a peripheral IV. Or perhaps they are a hard stick and there's a lot of difficulty sampling blood from them or placing IVs every 3 days. Advocating for what the patient needs is part of your nursing role. For peripheral IVs, optimal sites are selected when possible. These include cephalic and basilic veins in the forearm, wrist, and hand. Veins in the antecubital space are sometimes called pipelines because they're so easy to see and enter. but these veins can be problematic. We use this area as a last resort because infusion rates and patency can be easily impacted by the patient bending the arm at the elbow. In addition, the lab really likes to reserve these veins for blood sampling. Because blood sampling can happen every 4 to 6 hours in the acute care setting, your patient will appreciate it also. Whenever an IV is placed in an extremity, be sure to assess pulses and circulation of that extremity. This provides an assessment that can be documented every shift. Also, remember to avoid placing IVs on the same side as a mastectomy fistula or where blood pressure measurement is required. Always evaluate pain or tenderness at an IV site and provide intervention promptly. We're going to talk just briefly about midline catheters. Midline catheters are related more to peripheral IVs in that the tip of the catheter doesn't enter the superior vena cava or the heart. Midline catheters are usually about 8 to 12 centimeters long, and they are threaded through a peripheral vein. They typically start in the upper arm and end in the axilla. They are less invasive than central lines, but more invasive than peripheral IVs. Ultrasound may be used to place them properly. Nurses can obtain special training to place midline catheters. These catheters allow access for up to 14 days at a time without being changed. In some cases, they may be left in place for 3 to 4 weeks. But generally, by comparison, midlines and peripheral IVs are used for short-term therapy, whereas central lines are typically used for longer-term therapies. Because peripheral IVs are so common in the acute care setting, it's important to touch on the common complications. The most common complication is phlebitis. This is inflammation around the vein. It's fairly manageable if it's identified early. Phlebitis should be suspected when there is tenderness, red or inflamed areas along the vein path, or a hard cord-like vein when palpated. Many times, simply discontinuing the IV and finding a new site is all that's needed. For supportive care, warm compresses are soothing when there's a lot of pain. The next more severe type of complication is infiltration and then extravasation. Infiltration is leakage outside of the vascular space. This can happen when the catheter is not squarely seated in the vein, migrates outside of the vein, or goes through the back wall of the vein. Suspect this when there's a burning sensation and the vessel is spasming. This can cause swelling and pale or cool skin along the vein path. Extravasation happens when there is tissue damage as a result of an irritating fluid or medication going into surrounding tissue. Whether to apply cold or warm compresses is a common question by new nurses. Warm compresses every hour will help disperse the fluid faster and reduce pain. This is the best single supportive treatment. If swelling is considerable, elevating the extremity will also reduce pain. Certain drugs may require special steps to reduce further absorption and tissue damage, including elevation of the extremity, aspirating any remaining fluid, flushing with saline, and the administration of an antidote. Specific information about antidotes can be found in the package insert of the drug. Guidance about antidotes may be provided by your pharmacist. When an irritating medication or fluid leaks into surrounding tissue and causes tissue damage, it's called extravasation. Typical drugs that pose a risk for this include vasopressors and chemo agents. The last common complication is a hematoma. Many times you can see a hematoma develop rapidly as the vein wall is punctured. Other times it may develop slowly, especially in patients who are anticoagulated. If this happens, simply remove the catheter and apply direct pressure for at least 3 to 5 minutes. The sooner you apply pressure, the better chance to decrease the extent of the swelling. The blood that has accumulated under the skin will gradually dissolve, but this can be painful when hematomas are large. Again, a warm compress may help. Central lines provide options compared to smaller peripheral lines when certain medications or fluids are needed, including TPN or chemotherapy. They are also useful for monitoring hemodynamics and for providing things like dialysis. They are ideal for long-term intermittent use. So, key points for CVCs. These lines require an order and are placed by a specially trained provider. Common examples are Hickman and Groshong type CVADs, which stands for central venous access device. These tunneled and non-tunneled catheters are placed by clinicians. On the other hand, specially trained nurses can place PICC lines. We'll talk about PICC lines in a few minutes. Infusion therapy guidelines come from your state nurse practice act. These guidelines provide information on who can place a central line and who can access a central line according to their scope of practice. There are many types of central lines: tunneled, non-tunneled, single, and multi-lumen. It's imperative to know what device you are accessing. Some catheters require flushing with heparin and some do not. You cannot tell by looking at the device, so check the patient medical record. Tunnel devices are surgically inserted. They actually tunnel through the subcutaneous skin from one anatomical site to another, before ending in the superior vena cava. This is just above the heart. They are made with components to adhere to the underlying tissue to reduce the risk of catheter migration or movement, and they are meant for long-term therapy. Non-tunneled devices are inserted percutaneously, closer to the heart, usually on the chest. The catheter enters the subclavian vein before terminating in the superior vena cava. These are typically short-term central lines used in most acute care settings when urgent central access is needed over a period of a few weeks. They typically just require local anesthesia and they account for a large majority of bloodstream infections, so infection prevention is critical. They are sutured to the skin on the chest to reduce the risk of movement. Any central line, whether it is non-tunneled in the chest, a PICC line, or a port, must have the catheter tip location verified by X-ray before initial use. This means shortly after it's first placed. If a CVC is being used for dialysis, the general rule is that nothing else goes through the IV. Now that we've covered CVCs, let's talk about one type of central line. This is called an IV port. Nurses may see these less often, but they're super important and require unfamiliar equipment to access. If you're just learning about these, take opportunities to see how these devices are accessed and maintained. Ports are used in patients requiring long-term IV therapy and frequent blood sampling. The port is a self-sealing silicone-domed reservoir connected to a silicone or polyurethane catheter. Inside the middle of the part where the needle is inserted repeatedly, there is a septum. It rests just beneath the skin and can remain in place for years. We're going to talk in detail about ports, but before we do, let's cover some general key points. Ports are less likely to become infected compared with other central lines because they lie below the skin, which closes after each access is made. They are similar to getting a shot. the needle is inserted, and when it's removed, a very small hole will heal. Then it's ready to be used again. Most are about the size of a quarter or less. The distal tip of the catheter is positioned in the superior vena cava, near the entrance to the right atrium, just like other central lines. This means that ports can be used to administer large amounts of fluid quickly, or they can be used for irritating medications. Ports come in different shapes depending on the brand. Some are triangular and some are round. They may have a single or a double septum. Ports are placed surgically and they're allowed to heal before they are accessed. They are also confirmed with X-ray before the first time they are used. They are also marked in such a way that if an X-ray is performed, we can detect if they are flipped over inside the body. Nurses must use aseptic technique to access a port and cover the site, similar to accessing any central line. Let's talk specifically about the types of needles that must be used to access a port. These are Huber needles. Huber needles are non-coring needles. This means they won't damage the back of the port when they're inserted. The Huber needle is shaped at a 90-degree angle, and it's inserted into the skin, also at a 90-degree angle. So it's inserted perpendicular to the skin's surface. To enter the port, the nurse simply pushes straight down until the tip of the needle connects with the back of the port septum. Before insertion, the nurse may obtain an order for a topical anesthetic cream, but typically this isn't necessary. Huber needles come in a variety of sizes and lengths for different port locations and patient body types. Nurses should use the shortest needle possible, where the tip still makes contact with the septum. Generally, there are 20 or 22 gauge needles. Their length ranges from 1/2 inch to 1.5 inches. Patients often know their usual gauge and length, but if not, a 22 gauge 1.5 inch needle can be used for the first attempt. It's better that the needle be a little bit too long than a little too short and not be able to connect squarely with the port septum. If the needle is correctly sized, no more than 1/4 inch will protrude from the surface of the skin while still touching the back of the port. A Huber needle can stay in place up to 7 days. When not accessed, the catheter should be flushed at least once a month with saline or a heparin solution, according to protocol, during a hospital stay. After the site is accessed with the Huber needle, it's left in place and covered with a clear dressing. The site is often large enough that you have to stick 2 clear dressings together while maintaining asepsis to cover the entire site. Each facility has guidelines for how often to flush a port, usually similar to guidelines that they have for central lines. Here's a note about maintaining long-term catheters, including ports. You should always follow facility policy for maintaining port patency with heparin lock solution. Heparin lock solution is used to keep the port patent when used intermittently. Now, HepLock, also called heparin flush solution, is a different concentration than injectable therapeutic heparin. It's typically 100 units per ml for adults and 10 units per ml for children. When in regular use, a port should be flushed after blood sampling, before and after giving medication, at least daily, and before switching to intermittent use before deaccessing. So here are some things that nurses need to know before using a port. Port access requires a provider order. Depending on the purpose of the port, there are cases when a port may not be preferred for access and a peripheral IV is placed instead. An example would be suspected port infection. Always assess the port site for any signs of infection, such as redness, drainage, fever, or tenderness. If these are present, the port should not be used. Best practice is to obtain two port type identifiers to confirm the type of port being used. Some ports, called power ports, are able to withstand higher infusion pressures for CAT scan injections, and they require a special needle. These ports should be specially marked, usually with colored tape. Patients are expected to have a written identification of the brand, either an ID bracelet or card. Teach patients to always have this with them. If the port type is unknown and high flow infusions are planned, contact the facility where the port was placed to obtain details and recommend a chest X-ray to confirm placement. Some major risks for ports are infection, malposition, air embolism, and port occlusion. By using best practice, nurses can help prevent these complications. If the patient is exhibiting shortness of breath, tachycardia, anxiety, chest tightness, hypoxia, cyanosis or hypotension, an air embolism should be suspected. This is actually true for any central line that terminates in the vena cava. As part of best practice, nurses should always verify blood return before using a port. If blood return is absent or sluggish, or there is resistance to infusion, the catheter should be evaluated for occlusion, damage, or displacement. If fluids infuse freely but blood return is absent or sluggish, suspect a fibrin sheath formation or a kinked catheter. Try changing the patient's position or alternating flushing and aspirating in a push-pause method. Never force against great resistance. After accessing a port or any central line, be sure to document the date and time and the size of the needle used. Teach patients about signs for infection, malposition, air embolism, or occlusion. So lastly, we're going to talk about PICC lines. PICC lines, or peripherally inserted central catheter lines, are less invasive than other central catheters, but the tip still terminates close to the heart. There are some advantages to these central lines over others. The catheters are longer, allowing them to be placed in the same veins as a peripheral IV, but they terminate where a central line does, in the superior vena cava at the heart. They are usually placed just above or just below the antecubital space. Compared with a Groshong or Hickman shorter catheter that is placed percutaneously through the chest wall, there is no risk for pneumothorax during placement for a PICC line. These peripheral sites are also easily compressed, which avoids the risk for bleeding that certain patients may have. Think a patient on Coumadin. Coumadin can be a contraindication to placing a central line through the chest, because that site is not compressible should there be hemorrhage. On the other hand, these longer catheters can migrate if they're not secured. The tip can cause arrhythmias when this happens. Let's review main points about PICC lines. Because they are longer, the volume of heparin flush solution required to fill the catheter when not in use is likely to be greater than other central lines. For the same reason, flushes following medications need to have sufficient normal saline volume to clear the length of the line after they're given. Document and review the catheter length. This is how a nurse evaluates whether the catheter has migrated since its last use. Consider this especially when you're having trouble flushing the line. Like other central lines, use an infusion device for continuous infusions. Heparin is not typically needed for PICC lines, so check your facility policy. PICC lines are available valved or non-valved. And because these lines can easily be confused with peripheral IVs, be sure to label these lines as PICC lines. Now to summarize, let's compare all of these lines that we've talked about and talk about the advantages, disadvantages, and differences. In general, catheters are either short-term, which is less than 3 weeks, or long-term, used weeks to months. First, a non-tunneled CVC is for short duration. The entry site is percutaneously through central veins, either the internal jugular, subclavian, or femoral vein. The advantages are the percutaneous insertion, and they are relatively safe and inexpensive. The downside is their risk for infection and the inability to compress if there is bleeding. A second type of central line is the tunneled CVC. This is used for longer duration. It's usually implanted into the internal jugular, subclavian, or femoral vein. An advantage to this type of line is that a dressing is not needed after it's healed. It also carries less risk for infection. The main disadvantage is the increase in cost for it to be surgically placed. And it may not be the best option when conditions are urgent or emergent. A third type of central line is the implantable port we talked about. This is inserted into the subclavian or internal jugular vein, but the device itself is tunneled beneath the skin. A needle can be inserted for intermittent access, or it can be left in place for continuous infusions. Some advantages include its low visibility and improved body image for the patient. It's ideal for patients who need this long term. It also results in less pain. There is virtually no site care in between usage, and there's low risk of infection. And lastly, we talked about peripherally inserted central catheters. Like non-tunneled central lines, these are very easy and quick to insert. They are put in percutaneously into a basilic brachial or cephalic vein in the arm. Unlike other central catheters, they can be placed by nurses who are specially trained. They are relatively inexpensive compared with other central lines. They can be used for short or intermediate duration. The downside is they can be difficult to position into a central vein, and they have the potential for occlusion. They do, however, have a lower rate of infection than non-tunneled CVCs. Well, that's all for this podcast all about IV access. You can find other podcasts in this series and reference topics in the My Nursing Mastery app, or simply go to mynursingmastery.com and sign up.